Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I talk with Mackie Saturday. Mackie is the designer behind the logos of some of the biggest names in tech, like Instagram and Oculus, as well as a principal at the world-renowned Chermiff, Geismar & Haviv in New York City. I talk with him about getting a BFA in metalworking, starting his freelance business and growing it to where he is working with some of the best-known brands in the world, what his process is when designing for companies at scale, how his partnership with CGH came about, and more, all right after this. Jack Prince is one of our favorite companies to work with. They offer great products at even better prices, with some of the best customer service I've ever seen. Why not pick Jack Prince next time you need t-shirts, business cards, stickers, or flyers printed? Right now, Jack Prince is offering 4-day turnaround on their most popular apparel products. That's 4 days with no rush fees, no hassle, and no BS. With apparel from popular brands like American Apparel, Next Level, Gildan, Allstyle, and more, starting as low as $3.99 each. Now is the time to take advantage of this great offer. Visit jack.inc/4days to order your apparel today. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 20% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code CREATESOUTH17 at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. We've gone through and streamlined the Creative South Podcast Patreon page, cleaning out the excess and making it easier for you to support us. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. Every dollar helps cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please help support the podcast and become a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Mackie, thanks for joining me tonight.
Hey, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So let's dive right in. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northern California, a little bit north of San Francisco, actually.
Okay.
Most people are familiar with like the Bay. I was born in a small city called Chico. Mm-hmm. It's about 2.5 hours north of there. And then born and raised in and around that area, a little bit south, a little bit north.
So you're a California kid?
Yeah, born and raised out there. I used to have a thing as a child where I didn't own a pair of pants, and that was always this funny thing, and I hated pants, and my mom was like, you've got to buy some pants, you know, it's going to get cold, and I was like, it's never cold, and you know, whatever, so I just never owned pants.
So at least you owned shorts, and you weren't just like running around in your underwear, right?
No, I was just in my underwear all the time. No, I was, you know, it was, when I was a kid, it was like, I was out in California growing up in the early 90s when your shorts were like as long as pants anyway, so it didn't matter.
Mid-calf, so it really didn't matter.
Exactly. And then you pulled the sock all the way up to your knees, so everything was still covered.
So when you were growing up, were you, after as a sportsy kid, or were you more of an artsy kid?
I was a mix between an artsy kid and kind of a jock kid, just because my dad was always big time into sports. Sure. And so he had me plugged into everything from soccer to baseball to basketball and everything else. And so I did a lot of that. And then I did a ton of art, though. Art was always something I did that nobody else in my family was interested in. But for some reason, I had this inkling to do it. And I was always excited about it and have done it as long as I can remember.
So you were the outlier of the family going into art, huh?
For sure. And there's always a joke of like, we have no idea where you got any of this talent from and nobody could help you with anything. But,
well, I mean, you know, you could have been like a math major and gotten really far in that and nobody would have been able to help you with that either.
That's true.
So one may eventually end up outpaying the other if you had done that.
That's possible.
Math majors seem to be making a lot of money right now.
They're doing all right, I think.
Yeah.
It's okay. I'd rather draw pictures than crunch numbers.
Yeah, me too. when you were growing up, were you taking a lot of art classes and stuff, or were you just kind of doodling on your own?
I never did anything besides school. I never took anything extracurricular for art. But I was always, I guess primary school, whatever, you're always have an art class. And then I would do a lot of stuff at home on my own. There was my parents tell me lots of stories about being young and like me freaking out and crumbling up my drawings that I was working on for hours. And they're like, what are you doing? And I would always say, it doesn't look like what I see in my head. And it was so frustrating to me that I would just crumble these things up and throw them away. Or my dad always jokes with me about drawing every single scale on a fish. But that was something that I would always do. I just always cared about the detail to an unnecessary extent.
Well, that makes sense that you went into graphic design then.
I guess so.
Because that's like half of our job is caring about the detail.
Yep, absolutely.
So when you get out of high school, do you go to college or do you drive right into kind of working and doing stuff?
Oh, I went to college. I went to college for art, not for design. That was the thing.
Gotcha.
So I actually have a fine art degree.
Sure. So where did you go to school?
In Colorado. So that was how I ended up out there.
So what made you decide to go from?
So I was actually in Wyoming right before that. So it wasn't California to Colorado. I had gotten moved to Wyoming later, like right before going to college and everything. So I went to high school in Wyoming, and then Colorado was out of Wyoming, which was the ultimate goal no matter what.
Sure. Well, let's back up a little bit. How does your family go from Northern California to Wyoming?
It's a harsh, harsh situation.
Yeah.
My father does fitness. Mm-hmm. So he used to run health clubs.
Sure.
And he had an opportunity to go to Wyoming to start a whole new franchise of health clubs out there. Oh. And run those. And so we moved out there because of that. It was a great opportunity for him.
Gotcha. And you said you moved out there during high school or?
Before, actually. Oh, before. So I went to all of high school out there.
Yeah. What was that like?
It's like it was just a shock to the system.
I can imagine.
For sure. But the thing with going to Wyoming was that was actually where I picked up all of the stuff that I kind of continue to do now. That's where I started skateboarding. That's where I started snowboarding. You really had to, you know, find things to do. There's nothing to do there.
Sure. Not so much on the surfing, but
yeah, didn't pick up that there, but got into the other board sports there. And so, yeah, Wyoming was really where I kind of became more of who I really am today. Cause it was just skateboarding, snowboarding, and art.
Sure. Well, so what made you decide to go to Colorado for college?
I had a few different opportunities of where to go, but ultimately Colorado was, I could still snowboard a lot. Mm-hmm. I had been offered a great scholarship for art there.
That's helpful.
And I wanted to continue doing that. And Colorado was always a place that I had enjoyed, and they had really good skate parks. So I liked that. But it was a really big question of go back to California. Mm-hmm. Cause obviously that was kind of the original thought.
Sure.
Was just go back out there. Cause that's where I love, and go back home or try something new. And I have a tendency to opt for the try something new.
Gotcha. No, I can definitely understand the thought of going back home. Like when I was growing up, we moved quite a bit. Especially like when it got to high school time. So when it came time to me looking at colleges, I did not have scholarships. My grades were horrible, all that. So I went where it took me.
Yeah.
But you know, I considered going back and, you know, going to school in Minnesota where I grew up. So I definitely understand that. So I don't know. I got a little try something new in me, but not, I may not be as adventurous as you with that one.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up in Colorado.
Gotcha. And where did you go to school in Colorado?
This place called the University of Northern Colorado, UNC.
It's in a
town called Greeley.
Okay.
Kind of a small town just north of Denver.
Okay.
There's this trifecta of Division I schools right there. So there's CSU, CU, and UNC, and they're kind of this triangle of Colorado colleges.
Gotcha. And you said you were studying art there. Were you just doing general art studies? Did you focus on like painting or ceramics or something like that?
So yeah, you have to pick a focus there. You do have to. And I picked metalsmithing, not because I had any desire to be a metalsmith, but just because that was, no, it totally was that I didn't know anything about it, and I wanted to do something that I felt like I could learn.
This was the most out there major that they offered in the art department, so you decided to pick it?
It wasn't an option, actually. I forget what they were called, like a focus area was offered. So I had to get a special permission to do it as all on independent studies to get my focus in that area.
How did you talk them into that?
I talked to the dean, which was good, but it all paid off. You know, like I really liked the teacher, and she had always really pushed me, and she was really in that area. So I wanted to do some more work with her, and I liked the idea of doing more self-directed work for the end of my college career rather than just standard curriculum. And so by doing this, I had to do it all through these independent studies, which forced me to treat it much more like real world practice. And so, yeah, I talked to the dean and he approved it. And honestly, I think it paid off because it turned into me getting a full ride for the remainder of my college too. Through that, he was impressed. So
that worked out well.
Yeah. It was like, I got to do something that I was never going to use, but at least it didn't cost me any extra money.
Cover that out of state tuition.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, other than just studying metalworking and, you know, I'm assuming getting into like sculpture and things like that through it, did you have any plans to do anything with that?
I got a education certificate too, so I could be an art teacher. So,
okay. Well, that makes sense.
Because I was like, I got to make money, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I can do. I'll be an art teacher. But no, I was really just enjoying kind of being a practicing artist while I was in school and taking as many classes as I could that were just things that I liked doing, and things that I felt that I didn't have experience in, because I grew up and always had done a ton of drawing and painting and very standard artwork, and had actually, that was how I was supporting myself through college too, was just on commissioned art.
Sure.
And then I started taking all these classes in like metalsmithing and ceramics and just things that I had never done before. Not because I had an intention of doing them afterwards. It was just, I felt that, I'm going to college to learn. I should really try to work on things that I know nothing about.
Sure. I definitely understand that. Well, so what do you do when you get out of college? Cause like you said, you've got a certificate in education. You've done your focus in metalwork, which is definitely not a, go out there and find a 9-to-5 job and,
making some huge sculptures. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't exactly happen. So I took a job as a teacher.
Okay.
I got offered a job before I graduated, signed the contract, everything, felt like I was doing what I was supposed to do, and went and taught art for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And then before that year was up, I knew that it wasn't the place where I wanted to spend all of my time. It wasn't that it was any different than what I expected. It was exactly what I expected.
Sure.
But I realized that I was probably the wrong person for it. There are people that were much more passionate about teaching than me.
Sure.
And I was frankly very bored, and I had the opportunity. I had friends who really needed jobs too and wanted to be art teachers. And so I actually was able to hand it off to a friend of mine that really needed a job, which was great.
Oh, that's nice.
And yeah. And, from there, that was when I went out and started doing design.
So you don't have a background in design, really. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you probably took some classes. You know, you took one class when you were in college.
I learned how to use Photoshop. That was it.
So how do you make that transition from, you know?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So I was the 2 summers before I graduated, and then the summer after I graduated, and when I was teaching. And then subsequently the summer after I quit, all that time I was traveling for skateboarding too. And when I would do that, I started designing a little bit, just because we needed graphics for skateboards. We needed websites for the companies and things like that. And so I was like, well, I like art. I can figure out how to do it on a computer. and that was essentially what I was doing. Through that, I became, I don't know, enlightened to the fact that design wasn't really a joke. It was a real challenging art form.
Sure.
And that I could do a lot more with it than I realized I had been very closed-minded to it, honestly. And
why is that?
I kind of, when I was younger, my mom always told me I should take graphic design classes, like in high school.
Oh, so you're just rebelling against mom?
Exactly. I said, no, mom, they're cheaters. They use computers. And like I was trying to be a purist or something.
I had a friend in college who was a painting major who refused to paint anything using photographs as a reference because real painters don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. I was one of those idiots. So that was kind of the thing that I had just been closed-minded to it. I never had learned about how many, astonishing designers there were out there that were doing, amazing things that I could follow in their footsteps. And then my eyes kind of got open to that through some friends who had pursued design and had been successful and that were also in the skateboard industry.
Sure.
And so through that, I started doing a little bit more work here and there. And frankly, it was just doing the best work I could for everybody that I was doing work for. And there was enough word of mouth from that more and more work came in.
Gotcha.
I mean, right when I very first started, I was like, anybody who just needs something done, I'll do it, whatever it is. I knew that I just had to do work for people and it had to be good work and people had to enjoy working with me and that would in time pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because it was really just that. And I know it doesn't sound like much, but here's a funny story.
Sure.
Right when I was starting, I put an ad on Craigslist that said, do you need design? I'll do it for free.
Oh, jeez.
And people of course thought it was fake, but one guy wrote back and was like, is this for real? And I was like, yeah, totally. I really just need practice. And he had like a little newspaper and he needed a logo for his newspaper. And I said, great. And I did a logo for this newspaper for free for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up being so happy that then he came back and paid me to design a bunch of ads for the newspaper and do some layout design and these other things. So it was like I volunteered some of my time and then I ended up getting some paid work out of it.
Gotcha. You're learning on the job at this point. How are you determining what's good and what's bad and other than like client feedback?
Oh, it was horrible. I mean, it was, it was, my eye versus the world,
sure.
which is kind of dangerous. And I was studying design a little bit on my own. I was doing some reading. I was looking into what was good design. Mm-hmm. And of course I was always very observant. Just as an artist and having an artistic eye, I was always looking at things and understanding, this is good design and this isn't good design, just from an artistic perspective. And I was doing my best to create things that I could stand behind and be proud of.
Sure. So, where do you...
And even at that point in time, I didn't trust client feedback and I still don't most of the time. So.
I can understand that. There's a lot of times where it's really bad. Unless you're working with, like an internal design department that understands the concepts of it. I mean, even then it can be, sometimes
honestly,
that could be worse.
Honestly, I found that there's no formula. Just sometimes you have a person with a great set of eyes on the other side of the table and they have no qualifications, but man, they know what good design is.
Sure.
And sometimes you have the most qualified person ever and they seem blind to it. So.
Gotcha. As you're learning and as you're growing, are you just taking everything that comes your way or are you starting to be picky?
When I started, it was, take anything and everything under the sun.
Sure.
I was like designing websites for used car dealerships and, like whatever I could get. But it wasn't too far in that I started to get busy. And so I started to be selective. And the first way I was selective was not necessarily around client, but it was around the type of work that I did. I decided, hey, I don't want to do all forms of design. I don't think that being a generalist is good for me. I really want to be a specialist. And that was when I started honing in on doing, logos, really visual identity design.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started saying, hey, sorry, I can't do a website. I'm only doing this type of work.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly that became a pretty centralized focus of mine. And then I was able to start picking clients within that focus.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out how to ask this.
Go for it.
You're you're essentially freelancing at this point.
Absolutely.
With 100%. With not much background in design other than the one class and then being Zero. Self-taught. How are you finding, other than posting ads that I'll do design work for free, how are you learning the business side of things to find new clients and all of that stuff? Because there's many aspects to it.
There is, and all I ever did and all I can really stand behind was I focused heavily on building very good relationships with everyone I worked with.
Sure.
And even if it wasn't something that I was passionate about or something that I would be excited to show off, I wanted them to feel like they were getting the best work that they could possibly get and that I understood them better than anybody else could and that I would do more than anybody else would. Mm-hmm. And that led to a lot of continued relationships that brought in a lot of work that really helped me get through the first couple years. I mean, I would say 50% of my work through my first 5 years in design was always from a handful of clients that just were, they themselves were successful entrepreneurs and would just continue to bring more and more work to the table.
So they were bringing more and more work of stuff that they were working on. I'm assuming they were probably referring people to you as well at that point.
Absolutely.
Got a buddy that I know who needs something done.
Yeah. And if you're doing good work and it's getting out in the wild, then people see it. They go, "Hey, I love your new logo. Who did that?" Mm-hmm. And they were happy to refer me. And so, yeah, it's laughable in the simplicity of it sometimes, but it's also extremely complex to manage relationships like that and to build those type of relationships and uphold someone's trust for many, many years. That's really the hard part. Easy to talk about, hard to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so let's talk about that building those relationships and building that trust. Cause I think that's inherently how businesses stay in business. I mean, there's always outliers, but you've got to have strong relationships and you've got to build things and maintain that stuff. What's your process to that?
Yeah. I mean, imagine it this way. Like we just talked about how most of the time the client doesn't know what they're looking for even.
Sure.
So how would they know the difference of who's a good designer and who's a bad designer?
Sure.
They're only going to look at results. And if your work is helping them get the results that they're looking for, you're the greatest designer that's ever, that's ever lived in their mind.
Sure.
But it's not just about results.
No, there's a lot of soft skills that go in there.
There's a ton of soft skills that go in there. And, it's hard for me to say, what really changed things or what really worked well for me outside of, I just genuinely cared about the people I was working with.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be personable with them and I would, bend over backwards to help them. I know it's laughable, but, I delivered. I was always like true to my word.
Mm-hmm.
I never was a flaky artist. It was like if they said they needed it Tuesday and I said I would have it for them on Tuesday, they had it on Tuesday.
That's always helpful.
Or they had it, or they had it on Monday.
Sure.
They delivered ahead of time. It was those simple business skills just of like service that really pay off even in an industry like design.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my dad always told me, I remember this, we were, this is when I was in college in the summer, I had picked up a job like installing sprinkler systems to make some extra cash. And he came out and helped me literally like dig trenches to install sprinkler systems.
Sure.
Yeah. And I remember he told me, he goes, I don't care what you do when it's all said and done, whether you dig trenches for the rest of your life or whatever it is, just whatever you do, be the best at it. Be the, not just the best you can be the best that there is. And so I've always taken that simple but very challenging statement to heart and said, okay, well, I'm going to put all I have into it and more. And that's into every part of it, not just into the technical deliverable. It's the whole experience.
Sure. So moving forward, you've been doing this stuff and I'm assuming for the longest time you were fairly local. At what point do you start working with bigger national clients, and how does that happen for you?
Well, it honestly, the very first work I did outside of the like little local newspaper stuff, mm-hmm. some of the skateboard stuff that I did, that was on a national level okay. immediately, because skateboard brands are distributed, and so it's going all over the place.
Sure.
So that was helpful, that some of that first work was seen by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then after that, that was also subsequently where like my next round of really national level work came from. It was just some other action sports brands. It was in snowboarding, mm-hmm. because I had friends who became art directors and things like that, and they said, oh, I know that he's done this work, and they would reach out and, you know, do a small project here or there, a small branding project for some bindings or whatever. But then those names start to pile up and people start to trust you more, and they start to reach out when they're seeing that you're doing work mm. for these larger scale companies. And so, yeah, my next really, if things grow outward and like we have this sure. small inner, well, my next circle of exposure really came from that, from still people I knew, but people that I knew branching out into other roles and then bringing me in to help them, you know, in the companies that they were at.
Gotcha. So these were like friends from college and stuff like that, that had moved on, exactly. that had started doing bigger things, yeah. that were, had kind of just seen what you were doing with other things and were like, hey, he'd be a good fit for this project.
Exactly. It was, you know, friends who took the more traditional path and wanted full-time jobs.
Sure.
And they said, hey, we need somebody to help us. We need a freelancer to help us, you know, with this campaign or whatever. And they're working at some ad agency, or they're working at some big branding agency, whatever. Or they're working in-house at some of these companies, and they would, you know, call me up when the project that would fit came along.
Gotcha. So let's jump forward, because I think, you know, you've had some extremely high profile jobs.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got, like, you did the branding for Instagram and Oculus and Lux, and there was one other one on that I'm just blanked on for some reason. That's pretty prominent.
There's been a few. The most recent one was, not the most recent one, but one that a lot of people know about. It's like Silk. You know,
the yes, milk. That was the one that I was blanking on. Literally, yeah. Like, it's milk, something milk, but it was mm-hmm. like, that's not it. So, you know, all of these are not just national level, but these are international companies, and these are designs that are at scale.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're working within the Facebook environment of, you know, Instagram and Oculus and all that, how does that process work, and how does that process differ from, you know, a smaller client? I'm not saying mom and pop necessarily, but there's so many layers of intricacy, and a lot of times there's a lot of committees, you know.
Mm-hmm. There can be. So what's funny is Instagram, I started working with them before they were acquired.
Okay.
They were actually acquired during the process.
Oh, I'm sure that threw a few monkey wrenches into the...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was pretty sure once they were acquired that the project was over, you know, that Facebook would would wipe it out and just do whatever. But sure. All it really meant was a long pause in the middle, mm-hmm. Which was interesting. And then we came back together and made it work. But I will say that process, for example, was really smooth, because they had a very smart internal design team. And Kevin, the CEO, is an extremely talented guy, and he has a good eye for design. He had designed all the original elements for Instagram, both the app and the branding and everything. He had done it himself.
Oh, wow.
And so he was very trusting, and he was like, he knew what was good. He had the ability to see things and know what was good and what was bad and know what he wanted. And then he also knew when to step aside and say, hey, I'm good with this. I trust you guys. You know, take it to the finish line. And then, and Mark is the same way. He's kind of just wants experts to do things. So that process was actually very, very smooth and easy. Oculus, which is, again, at scale, and this was after they were acquired.
Sure.
It did have some more committees involved, but I didn't have to deal with them. It was set up in a way where their art director was himself handling it all. just because of strange internal things, which was totally terrifying because it's not good to kind of, it feels terrible to just kind of hand your designs over and be like, take care of my baby.
Yeah.
You know, good luck.
Speaking from experience. But, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really what I would advocate to do ever, but it worked out in my favor there. And in that case, we had made something that was so simple and was exactly what they wanted. It really kind of came down to just getting it cleared from a trademark perspective, that legal side of things, because that was the impetus for the project, was that they needed something proprietary that they could use and own, because they couldn't own the eye that they had. And so once we were able to get something that they were happy with from a visual perspective and then that they could own legally, that was really the key. And a lot of times with companies that are at scale, with these large companies, that is a huge part of the process. It's a lot about, yes, what they want to have, but there is a real factor of what they can own. And a good trademark, a good logo, yes, it needs to be very simple. It needs to be unique in some way, but ultimately it just needs to be, you know, awkward enough in some kind of way that it persists in the mind, mm-hmm. and it can become everything to that brand, but it needs to be ownable by that brand.
Sure.
So when you start talking about working at scale like that, a lot of times those things come to the forefront a lot more than stressing over a clever idea.
I can imagine when you are getting into that process where it's coming down to, hey, I've presented, I don't know how many ideas you present, or if you're just a, you know, throw one out there.
I present options.
Yeah.
I present options. Yeah.
And it comes back and it's, you know, they've got to run it through legal. And then there's so many things out there that have been designed. It's hard to design something original anymore or completely original anymore. Even if it's not, I'm not saying that you like obviously go out and do that. That would be weird. Uh-huh. When they run it through that legal, how is that feedback loop? What is that feedback loop like of, hey, we really like this, but our legal team ran it through and company XYZ in, you know, France has something that's kind of similar to that. And they are in a similar realm to what we do. Mm-hmm. Do you start over completely or do you tweak?
It depends. Nowadays I try to, if we can, to always run things through a preliminary trademark search before they're even presented.
Sure.
That way you stay out of that situation completely, because when you do work at scale with really large companies, you don't have a lot of time with the decision makers, mm-hmm. you know, with CEO and stuff. And so
you're lucky if you get 15 minutes.
Right. And so you just can't run the risk of putting something in front of them that they could fall in love with that they then couldn't own.
Sure.
And so doing, you know, maybe you don't always get to do that for every presentation. Maybe you're working with an internal team and you're figuring out a bunch of things. But then once it's narrowed down, then you're at least getting that trademark search done before you're going to the top level to assure that, hey, you have something that, you know, that they can take any one of them and use it tomorrow. That's key.
Sure.
But to your question, when that does come up, so like, say we did a round of designs and we're working with an internal team and we all resonate towards a couple of them. And then maybe there's one that we're really excited about, but it doesn't clear legally. Then we look at why doesn't it clear? And is there a way that we can tweak it that makes it proprietary? Mm. Or is it a non-starter? And we just have to say, sorry, but we can't have that one. And both situations happen and you just have to be okay with that. One of the greatest skills you have to have as a logo designer is the ability to throw away 99.9% of your work.
Sure. And then cry about it later.
Yeah.
Or drink heavily, one of the two.
Whichever works, or both.
Yes. Sometimes both at the same time. Yeah. So speaking to that end, you know, especially when you're designing at scale that large, there mm-hmm. also comes a lot of design critique.
Of course.
And I don't mean internally. the social media landscape is full of trolls that love to hate on everything and personally attack. How do you defend yourself against that? Because that, you know, us artists, we tend to be sensitive, emotional types a lot of times.
We do. And I think it's important to understand where your value comes from outside of design too. That's it's a security thing.
Sure.
And so that's very helpful to make sure that you are not completely and solely fulfilled by your work. That's like step one. And then step two is realizing that what all of them say doesn't matter at all to the success of the design. If you have fulfilled the needs of the design task, if you've solved the problem well, and it's something that you're proud of, it's really going to end up working for the company. And in time, it's going to be, as long as the company themselves don't tank and become a terrible company, that logo, you know, will just become the representation of them. And all of these ideas that people had about it, or these opinions, likes, dislikes, whatever in the beginning, those all kind of fade away, and the personality of the company overtakes them all.
Sure.
So it's taking the long view and not being too worried about people's initial perceptions, because heck, I hate some of my designs right when I do them even. And then all of a sudden they grow on me because they really do just work. And that's kind of the magic.
Gotcha. Do you ever just go on Twitter and all of a sudden see something that somebody said about one of yours and just go,
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I am human, and it doesn't not sting, but at the same time,
you don't let it define you or ruin. Yeah, you try not to let it ruin your day.
Yeah, try not to let it ruin your day, because. Yeah, I have to hold myself to a really high standard in the first place. And if I'm not proud of the design, I shouldn't let it go out into the world at all.
Sure.
And I should be ready to defend it from anybody. And most of the time, critique comes from people that don't actually know the situation or don't know the constraints.
At 99.9% of the time.
Right. Occasionally, there is a real critical eye out there, and they make a good point, and you can be like, yeah, touche. That's a fair point, but yeah. those are few and far between.
Well, I mean, how do you feel about that design criticism just on a general whole? Because there's so much out there of, like you said, people who don't have the information and they just want to, for lack of a better term, they want to stir up shit and they want to pick fights, and, you know, they're attacking other designers when they've had. They haven't had a dog in the fight of what that logo is or what that project is. How do you feel about, you know, trying to find the word?
I think, no, it's fine. I think we need a proper platform for design critique.
Yes.
And when Dribbble first came out, that's kind of what it was, which was awesome. I remember being on there very early on. And you would post work, and it was a very select group of individuals that were there that were all very well respected. And every comment, for the most part, was some type of feedback. It was about, back then it was like, it wasn't show and tell for designers or whatever. It was like work in progress. That was the thing. It was a place where you posted stuff that you were working on so that all of these freelancers could have peers to actually talk about what they were doing. And so I remember, you know, we post things and you would have five designers that you respected come in and give you good critical feedback. And you'd have an opportunity to have a dialogue around what's the needs, what are the, like, what don't we know? And it was a very respectful place. And I think that something like that could be very helpful. Obviously, everybody's not going to join something like that and abide by the rules and whatever. But I do think that any type of outlet would help with the current situation of just excessive amounts of design critique without any type of information or formal place for the work to be displayed.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think people now, it's not even design critique. It's just people being critical of design,
design
and criticizing. And that doesn't help anybody. I mean,
no, it doesn't. It's funny that design has gotten popular enough that there's enough of it and enough people out there to critique it or to criticize it all the time, that can be a thing. Design used to be so much more under the radar, and now it's something that, you know, it used to be a company would change their logo and nobody ever noticed or update their advertising or whatever. And now it happens and even your grandma knows about it somehow, you know, it's news. And that's really changed. So I like that people are aware of the visual world around them. I think that's important. It is always valuable, but more people see it as valuable. But people are critical of everything. People are critical of all types of art at an unreasonable level. I look at musicians and they get it worse than anybody.
Poor Nickelback.
You know, poor Nickelback. But yeah, they get unnecessarily critiqued all the time, criticized. And formal artists throughout the decades and throughout the centuries have been criticized, you know, their entire lives.
Sure.
And then
sure.
And praised after they were gone.
Yeah, well, yeah. And there's some that are still getting criticized well after they're gone. So
yes, sure.
So
I think it's we sign up for it. You know, it's, and I don't think we're going to change it. I think we can let it affect us, or we can try to take a longer, more iconic approach to what we do, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. say, okay, I want to rise above it, and I want to make things that can create a legacy of design. And there's going to be a lot of haters on along the way, and I'm going to do my best to just stay above reproach, not give them any real places to sink their teeth, and do the best work that I can.
Sure, sure. I want to get back to that in a second, but I want to move forward in your career a little bit.
Sure.
To the past couple of years, because has it been 2 years now since you?
Yeah, year and a half.
Year and a half. Okay, year and a half since you went to CGH. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? And what ultimately made you decide to stop, you know, being team of one essentially, and join
and go there
the partnership?
Sure. So it came about through me reaching out to them a year prior to that about some mentorship, because I was really struggling with having any type of good critique with my work.
Sure.
Or having any type of guidance at that point, where there were very few people that I respected that I could ask to look at things with a critical eye and help me get better. And so I went to who I believe to be the best in the world. Mm-hmm. I know Ivan and Tom have been graphic design partners for 60 years this year.
Holy
which
God.
Is crazy. Yeah. You know, they have logos that are twice as old as me, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, go to the top of the mountain, and they welcomed me in, Siggy specifically, and started offering me their time whenever I was in the city, which was pretty often for work. Mm-hmm. And then I was getting ready to actually move back to San Francisco full time from Colorado, because I had a small team working with me because it was just too much work to manage.
Sure,
on my own.
Sure.
And I had an office out in San Francisco and an office in Denver, and I would go back and forth between the two. Mm-hmm. And we had decided, hey, let's go back to San Francisco. All our family's out there. The majority of my work is out there. Realistically, there's not really much work in Denver. Mm-hmm. And I was out in New York, and I told Siggy that I was going to do that. And then 2 hours later, he sent me an email and was like, hey, well, since you're moving, would you consider coming here instead?
And what was your reaction? What was your immediate honest reaction?
I was confused. I was just totally confused. And so it took, you know, some thinking. I talked to my wife and said, you know, this is as cliche as it sounds, it's a true once in a lifetime opportunity, because these guys are kind of the last remaining legends, mm-hmm. of graphic design, of the first era of graphic design, because, you know, they started when graphic design didn't exist.
Yeah.
They started when it was still commercial, like being a commercial artist at an advertising agency. And they were some of the pioneers that took it into a design studio only. Mm-hmm. So, it's totally cliche, but once in a lifetime opportunity to work with people that are on that level, and to learn from them. And I said, you know, I have to do it.
Gotcha. So how did your wife feel about that? What were her thoughts? Cause I mean, she's got a career of her own as well. She's not,
she does. She does. She has a much more important career than me. She saves children's lives.
Yeah.
You know, I draw pictures. She saves the lives of kids.
I'm finally glad that a designer has actually made that statement. I've seen far too many people who take what we do way too seriously.
No. She has literally children come to her, and she saves their lives. Way more important. but she was incredibly supportive. She was the, I mean, she was pushing me like, you can't not do this. You have to do this. It won't come up again. And so, she actually had some great job offers in California that she passed on and, came out here and works night shifts and has a very hard life still supporting us doing this. So she's been an amazing support system through it all.
So how has the culture shock of living in New York been for you versus living in Denver and living on in San Francisco area?
We love living here. It's not really, it's a shock in the opposite way of what I would imagine. I have less stress. My home is quieter. I have more free time. It's all the opposites of what everybody would ever imagine with New York City. So
really?
It's, yeah. I mean, so I live on a park. I used to live like on a busy street when I lived in Colorado. now I live on a park and it's all green outside. These guys have been doing this for 60 years. They're pretty good at time management. Mm-hmm. So we don't often struggle with crazy hours or things like that. They know how to plan a project and how to get it done in time. Which is great. And then I share the burden also of all the work with three other principals.
Sure.
So it's a lot less stress on me in general. And so it's been very relieving living in New York, and we've really enjoyed it.
Gotcha. Yeah, because, I mean, when I think of New York, I think of things that are at a much faster pace and you've got mm-hmm. the hustle and bustle of the city and all that. So
yeah.
That's interesting take on it.
Yeah, it is. And that does exist. And I like some of that. I love having access to anything at any time. That is a huge blessing of being in New York City,
sure.
But also where we live, to be able to have total peace and quiet and calm escape just a few blocks from the subway.
That's not a bad deal at all. So,
no.
So I want to go back real quick to something you said when we were talking about the design criticism. Of it, you know, defending yourself against it, it helps to not have your identity wrapped up in it. Mm-hmm. How do you do that for yourself? How do you, you know, how would I phrase this? How do you say, you know, I'm Mackie Saturday. Hopefully, you don't talk about yourself in the third person.
Hello.
How do you say I'm Mackie Saturday? I'm a guy who does design versus I'm Mackie Saturday. I'm a designer.
So I still say the latter. I still am a designer.
Sure.
And I do find that to be an important part of who I am, not just what I do. I'm not on the side of the people who try to separate out design from themselves and think of it purely as a career, because it's not. It is a lifestyle, and it takes that type of dedication to really be great at it. However, people's opinion about the work I do does not define me. And there's a lot of things I've done in life that I have failed at, that I have struck out on, that I've made mistakes with in all aspects of life. But those are all just parts of like being a person.
I would hope you have failed at some things, because otherwise you would be the most boring person in the world.
Right. Totally. But I look at, you know, so design is just another part of that entire lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so I don't take in individual moments or individual projects as, I mean, they can be achievements, but they're not going to be things that, that define me in the kind of way where it's my identity is held up in one project. Mm-hmm. Where I only control a tiny portion of an outcome of all kinds of things.
Sure.
So, it's hard to explain, and it probably sounds contradictory in some ways, but there's a balance there, and it's a lot in your head.
Yeah. Well, so what are some things that you do, you know, kind of in your free time to keep your head on straight, to keep you
sure.
from getting wrapped up in things?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I still like to skateboard as much as I can, go surfing when I can, go snowboarding. I'm you know, anything with a board on it is probably good for me. But I also like, you know, I like fitness. I like just being outdoors. I like spending time with other people that do other things. Mm-hmm. And find a great value in just being friends with people. That in itself can be incredibly rewarding. And then another big thing is just finding areas and places to serve other people too. That keeps you in the right mindset, reminds you that you're not so important, that there are other people that are very much in need, and that you have the ability to change their life trajectories. Sure. And that can bring you in incredible levels of success and of reward, much more than a lot of, you know, design projects.
Can you give me an example of something that you found fulfilling like that?
Yes, there's quite a few.
I know, I'm putting you on the spot to narrow it down and think of one right off the top.
Yeah, no. But I mean, I don't talk about a lot of that stuff just because
And you don't have to say anything specific, just maybe a type of thing that you find fulfilling.
Yeah, I like working with and just spending time with people that have been marginalized.
Sure.
And giving them some of my time and showing them that they're cared for, and that somebody thinks that they're valuable enough to take time out of their life for them.
That's good. That's, you know, putting others above yourself is nice.
Yeah, I think it keeps you grounded.
Yeah, definitely. So, do you still find time to get any metalworking done?
No, I don't. And I'd also have to find a place to do it. Yeah.
You can't just do it in your apartment?
Start go out on my terrace and start welding or whatever. But I should. I want to make more time for doing that stuff. I'm thinking about getting a studio just a couple stops down on the subway. Mm-hmm. That will just be for art, you know, like not even have a computer in there type of a place, and have that set aside so I can go there on, you know, whenever I'm feeling the need to just create something that has no client, that has no reason outside of expression. So, because my life right now is so objective, like everything I create mm-hmm. has a purpose and has a problem to solve. And so it's very, very objective driven, but I'd love to do some other things that can be more subjective.
Just for you?
Yeah. I'll let other people see them, but I mean,
well, yeah, but like, I mean, you're just doing them for you. You're not worried about, yeah, you know, client feedback, exactly, or anything like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, we were talking real quick before we went on air about you having a busy weekend, and you mentioned like side projects and stuff like that. How are you finding time to do these things? Cause you know, you're now a partner in a very well known, very well established business. You know, you're doing other things to, you know, to help the community, and you're doing speaking engagements. You've got a wife, you've got, you know, all of these things. How are you finding the time to balance all of this stuff?
You just don't ever sleep. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, just it's taking small chunks. And so, I work on other projects, they're very limited, and it's mostly built around relationships that I've built in the past, people that I want to continue having a relationship with, and maybe they're just not the right fit for CGH, but sure, it would be good for them to, like, I still want to work with them. And then to make time for all these other things, yeah, it's scheduling, it's prioritizing things, and it's being effective with my time. I've never really been a big like television watcher or movie watcher or things like that, so I fill those gaps in, and I don't know. Yeah, I just kind of go from 5 a.m. till midnight every day, and that's how it works.
How do you avoid burnout with that? How do you?
Well, I do so many different things.
Sure.
That's really the piece that helps, is that it's not, if it was 5 a.m. to midnight of design, I'd be burnt out quick.
Yeah.
But since it's, you know, it's that, but it's mixed between, you know, waking up early to dawn patrol a surf session to be out of the ocean. You know, that's why I've got to be up early, so I can beat the sun, compared to another day where it's getting up to get some extra work done. Mm-hmm. And then another day it's to prep food for something or whatever. that is all, it's change. And so it is the diversity of things that I'm putting my time into that keeps me from feeling as though I'm getting burnt and makes it more like, wow, I'm just happy that I'm getting so much use out of the time that I have.
Sure. Any tips and tricks for being able to manage your time when you are that busy?
Scheduling. putting everything on the calendar. Mm-hmm. That was one, like a trick I found a lot of years ago was I gained some weight just sitting behind a computer all the time designing.
I know that feeling well.
Yeah. So it's like, hey, if I don't just start putting the time that I need to go work out on the calendar, I don't do it. And so I actually started taking like fitness classes and things so that I was accountable to being with people and they were waiting for me. And so I would always go. And then here in New York, that's like a giant craze now. So it's really easy. There's a million fun different, workout spots to go to. And then when I want to skate, I schedule it with people instead of just planning on going and skating alone or surfing alone. So there always is a commitment to someone else, which helps make you more likely to hold on to your commitments rather than when they're just to you.
Sure. Well, with going 5 a.m. to midnight, how do you avoid the physical wear and tear and the drain that can come from that as well?
Take a nap every once in a while. Naps are good. I do take naps. That's helpful. Because I've found that like mornings can be the most successful time for me. That's why I really like the early rising thing, is that mornings are kind of like untouchable. Nobody bugs you. Nobody can take them away from you. The day can always run away from itself and you can lose your evenings pretty quickly, but the mornings don't have that tendency. So that's why I try to maintain that time always. And then, some days I get to bed a little earlier, some days a little bit later. Mm-hmm. If I need rest, I make sure to get it as well, because you don't want to physically burn out.
Sure. Do you have any, I'm assuming you schedule time well ahead of time to take vacations to power down and kind of just shut your brain off for a while too.
Yep, we do. And then when we take the vacations, it's a total power down as much as I can.
I was about to say, how much can you when you are a partner in a business?
Totally. I can completely power down because these guys, there's three other dudes running the shop and they're amazing in terms of that, of wanting to assure that you have, like, if somebody's out on vacation, they're like, no, you don't do anything. You take vacation.
Gotcha.
Because it's important.
Could you explain that to my boss? She doesn't understand that concept.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. But, I guess she's got to work. She's got to do it for 60 years to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, by the time she gets to 60 years, I'll have well been retired. So.
These guys are the ultimate case of not burning out. They know how to do everything to not burn out.
Yeah.
And so I follow after them.
Cool. Well, so kind of wrapping up here, since we're about at our time, what exciting is coming down the pike for you that you're allowed to talk about?
I don't know. I really don't know. I really don't know what's exciting coming.
Any vacations planned
soon? No, I just got back from a good vacation.
Oh, that's right. You were in Spain and Portugal, weren't you?
Yeah. I went to Spain and Portugal, and that was terrific. Everybody should go. I'm going to try to surf as much as I can this summer. That's watch out for that. No, I'm kidding. But there's nothing crazy on the calendar. There's going to be some new releases from CGH that people can be very excited about that I cannot talk about yet, but there's going to be two separate, very, prolific releases that we're doing in celebration of 60 years in business.
Gotcha. Well, let me know when those come up and I will, post an addendum to the podcast and
sure. There will be an announcement at the AIGA conference that's in Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. So that's what, in a month?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there will be an announcement then.
Oh, that's perfect timing, because that's about when this episode will go up.
Hey, cool. So then you can check it out, and there's some cool things that we're working on there.
Awesome. Cool. So where can people find you online?
MackieSaturday.com, at Saturday on any of your social networks. Or
how'd you manage that one, by the way? How did someone not snag that before you?
Both of them were snagged before me, but I was able to get them after the fact. And then cghnyc.com for all of the stuff I'm doing with Ivan, Tom, and Saki.
Cool. Mackie, thank you so much for taking the time to chat
thank
with
you.
Me. And go out and hug some necks.
Deal. I'll do my best to spread the Southern love up here in New York.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. You can find out more about Mackie on Twitter at Saturday, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Creative SO Pod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA, over at creativesouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostel on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Visit jackprince.com and get 20% off orders over $25 when you use promo code CREATESOUTH17 at checkout. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CREATIVESOUTH. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.